The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
To Sportsnet Radio Network. Happy Saturday to you. I'm Ben Ennis. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello. And yes, much of the next 2 hours will be spent in a Viking funeral of sorts for the Toronto Blue Jays, who saw their season come to a close yesterday in a pretty dramatic fashion. 4-3 in Kansas City to the Royals. Two of the best games this postseason have been played by the Blue Jays. Yesterday, as good as it was, as exciting as it was, and as thrilling as that Jose Bautista two-run home run in the top of the eighth was, I still think you got to give the edge to Game 5 of the DS against the Texas Rangers. But spectacular run for the Blue Jays through the regular season, into the postseason, ends a little sourly. We'll spend the first part of this first hour looking back at the postseason. We'll look ahead to 2016 coming up after 11 o'clock. But Gary, I get hung up on a couple of things, and maybe it's actually better to start off with the overall breakdown of the American League Championship Series against the Kansas City Royals. Is it just simple enough to say the Kansas City Royals were the better team? They proved it in six games against the Toronto Blue Jays.
I think so. I mean, overall, Kansas City, I think, is a much more balanced team, and they show that. Their hitters got timely hits. They got some clutch hits from their offense. Their bullpen, as expected, was fantastic. And I think in the end, that just made the bigger difference in this series.
Craig, I mean, you look at 0-for-12 with runners in scoring position. It's easy to point at the hitters who were so good all season long in racking up the number of runs that they did, in hitting the number of home runs that they did. But at some point, and John Gibbons said this postgame, you got to tip your hat to the guys on the other side. This is some pretty good pitchers, especially the guys coming out of the bullpen for Kansas City.
Yeah, they're all throwing in the upper 90s. They're intimidating to no end. You have to tip your hat to those guys. I mean, your lineup, your 1-9, the Jays, we saw, they can hit the ball. They can knock it out of the park. Obviously, a little tougher in a bigger outdoor ballpark like Kauffman, but the wind's blowing out. There were opportunities last night for the Jays to hit, and man, they were painting the corners. There was a couple of calls that were a little controversial, but they were throwing good pitches at good opportunities and making the Jays work for it.
The Mike Moustakas homer. Anybody have a problem with that? I personally did not have a problem with it. I thought it was over the fence. I thought it was way too close to call, especially once it was ruled a home run on the field. I didn't think you could overturn it. In fact, I thought it was gone. What'd you think, Craig?
I mean, I kind of disagree. I feel like the kid's glove was over the edge of the fence, right? And I mean, I agree with you completely on the fact that I don't know that you can overturn that. Like, I mean, you send it back to New York, you send it back to those guys, and it's like, can we say for sure that this wasn't a home run? I can't.
Yeah, it was inconclusive. It was too close to kind of have to overrule that initial call on the field.
Right? Yeah, it's interesting to me, though, the guys who interfere with in-play balls who just wind up becoming lionized and, you know, everybody's interviewing them. And then the guys who immediately get kicked out, right? Like, you know, right. If you, in a regular season game, if you, you know...
Well, if they had ruled it the other way, that guy would have been booted.
Right. But at the same point, I feel like it was a call on the line, right? Like, and when he was doing the thing in the interview with Aaron Andrews, and he's like, "Oh, my glove was way back here." I leaned back, like, didn't you guys see me? I was running into the concession stands to catch that ball, right? Like, that's a little disingenuous, and I'm not cheering for that guy to keep that ball. I'm not cheering for him to stay in the stadium. But no, like, I agree with you guys in the way that it's not an easy call. It's like, oh yeah, definitely not a home run. Like, I can't say definitely not a home run. I can say borderline enough that I would have liked it somehow if that could have gone the other way, but no.
And yeah, who knows? Even if it's a double, maybe Mike Moustakas ends up scoring either way. And it wasn't the turning point in the game. When you're talking about maybe the turning point in this game, we mentioned the 0-for-12 with runners in scoring position. Gary, I mean, how many times does this team have to get a runner on second base with nobody out and not cash? It happened in the first, happened in the middle of the game, happened in the ninth inning. They couldn't get it done in situations where the major league average for scoring at least a run during the regular season is over 80%. Blue Jays just couldn't get it done.
Yeah, no, that was, you know, that was a big part of the story last night. And, you know, it wasn't just last night, too, in the series. If you look at that Game 2 loss, which, you know, if you ask me, kind of changed the face of this series, you know, they were 3-for-16 with runners in scoring position. So, you know, that's not something that this ball club can afford to do, especially when you're considering that most of their success all season long is based off them being an offensive juggernaut.
Yeah.
You know, if they're scoring 5-plus runs, they're winning ball games. You know, I think the numbers were like, I think they only won 4 times when they scored 3 runs all season long. You know, and they scored 3 runs last night, you know they're not going to get the win. You know, as long as they get that kind of 5-run mark, you know, they only scored more than 5 runs twice this series, and it was in both their wins. So when they're not getting to that kind of, you know, that benchmark, they drop a lot of games.
And it's an interesting study in contrast between the two teams, right? The Royals get a guy on first. It's like, you know, super likely that somehow that guy
scores on a single.
Exactly, right? Lorenzo Cain coming around on a single to right, like, and he didn't stop moving. Like, what a heads up play. Like, hats off to Lorenzo Cain. Like, what a player. But still, the Royals call it what, frenzied rally offense, right? Where it's just sort of, they get a single and they get another single and then just manage to pile up their hits. They manage to sequence them well. Where if they would have had runners on second and third last night or any night in the series, there is no way, 0% chance they don't get at least one run there. And that was the Jays story all series. They just couldn't get it done. And yeah, I don't know. That's frustrating to watch as a Blue Jays hopeful.
Well, and part of it was the guy standing on the pitching rubber, the guy throwing 100 miles an hour in Wade Davis, who sat for over an hour, came out there after the rain delay, and listening to Ned Yost postgame, it was interesting to hear his thought process, understanding that the rains were coming. He didn't want to get him into that game and then have him lost for the game because of a rain delay that they knew was coming. Instead, he leaves Ryan Madsen in there, and it's a tie ball game. Either way, Wade Davis came back out there. And, yeah, the Blue Jays did not execute with runners on second and third and nobody out. But, and it's not an excuse, and I'm glad it was not a huge topic of conversation post-game because, you know, it's baseball, there are bad calls. Mm-hmm. But, boy, were those at-bat-changing called strikes to Deonor Navarro and then again to Ben Revere. That were clearly up and out of the zone. Now, they were the exact same pitch, so I guess there's some level of consistency there, but it was a pitch that I didn't see called a strike the previous 8 innings. And if you go 3-1 to Ben Revere instead of 2-2, and you're not trying to protect, and you don't have to think about that big, devastating breaking ball, Wade Davis, and you know you don't need a base hit, and you have your best contact man at the plate, you just need a dribbler up the middle or a hard hit ball. It's hard not to look back at those two called strikes, Gary, and say things go differently if those are called correctly.
It certainly does. And I mean, I saw some, you know, there was some chatter about, you know, well, if he walks Ben Revere, Josh Donaldson still hits into that double play. You know, it's tough to say because if Ben Revere is on first and you got bases loaded, then Josh Donaldson probably shows a little bit more patience at the plate.
Maybe
changes his approach a little bit,
and it's a different space-time continuum as well. Who knows? Maybe doesn't hit it to third base in that situation. It was a huge call, obviously. And yeah, it doesn't guarantee that the Blue Jays win that game or anything, Craig. But in the end, you got the American League MVP at the plate with the go-ahead run on second base and two out in the ninth inning of a ball game. It's a spectacular way to finish the season,
which is what you want. And you know, Josh Donaldson went 0-for-5 last night. He didn't have a great game, but it's the stats out there. He hit that ball in the fifth inning with runners on.
Yeah,
114 miles per hour.
That's all.
Yeah, just a small amount of speed behind that ball. And you know, if it's 6 inches to the right, he's got at least a single, a run scores. You know, like he hit the ball hard at a couple of times, right? Like so, he got good wood on the bat, and it wasn't. It's not going to show up on the stat sheet, obviously, but he was, you love that situation, you know, like you have that situation before the game, like, hey, game on the line, Josh Donaldson, second and third, guys in second and third, you absolutely eat that up. You're like, great, let's do this. And, you know, it didn't work out for the Jays. It's not always going to do it. And, you know, credit to Wade Davis. But yeah, going back to the first couple of at bats in that inning, gives up the single to Russell Martin. And then the at-bat with Kevin Pillar, I don't think Wade Davis was getting the benefit of the doubt. You know, the Harold Reynolds or Verducci, whoever said it, on the broadcast was saying he's not locating. Wade Davis isn't locating like he was. His, you know, fastball's, you know, just as hard as it was in the previous to the rain delay, but he's just not locating. And then he wasn't locating perfectly, but he was getting the calls. And I think that made the difference.
It was a huge difference. And yeah, the Kevin Pillar bat was actually spectacular. What he did in this postseason, both defensively, obviously, which we saw all season long, and offensively for the most part as well, opened some eyes, not just here, but in the overall baseball viewing public in North America. I think Kevin Pillar has clearly established himself as the starting center fielder for this Blue Jays team. And there's a lot of interesting things to talk about for the Blue Jays as far as the outfield is concerned for 2016. We'll get to that in the next hour. One of the things that's not a question that is a huge advantage that the Blue Jays held this postseason and all season long is Jose Bautista, who has just etched his name into Blue Jays postseason lore with the big home runs he hit. Of course, Game 5, seventh inning against the Texas Rangers, the three-run shot to left field. In this game, it was the Jose Bautista show offensively, responsible for all three runs. The first home run, an absolute bomb to left field. He takes a high fastball over the wall and left off out of the hand of Ryan Madsen in that eighth inning to tie it up at threes. More clutch you could not be for Jose Bautista. And sometimes you don't see this. And we'll get to David Price in a second. But sometimes there's a narrative of a guy's never been in the postseason. You don't know how he's going to react. And Gary, there's no questions about Jose Bautista. Next time he's in the postseason, that guy's a clutch performer now.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and he certainly proved it. His first taste of the playoffs, and he was spectacular. Mm-hmm. He couldn't come up with more timely hits. It seems like, you know, the bigger the situation, the bigger Jose Bautista was. And you look at that second home run last night, mm-hmm. like, you know, there was talk of him spraining his ankle when he hit that solo shot. And,
yeah.
you know, apparently him telling John Gibbons, if I get on base, you got to put a pinch runner in for me. Like, how different does that game look if he doesn't just hit that bomb and he's coming out of the game?
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, going back to the bat flip homer in Game 5 of the Texas series, how many home runs or moments wind up as tattoos the very next day?
T-shirts, tattoos.
Yeah, that's a cottage industry, that one at bat, right? Like, and, you know, how many baseball players can say that they've had an at bat as big as that? Like, we can debate whether it's the biggest in Jays history. Joe Carter's up there, Bert of Alomar's up there. But, yeah, that was a moment felt around baseball the second it happened.
That was spectacular. Yeah, and that two-run shot yesterday, spectacular as well. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello. The Blue Jays lose Game 6 4-3 to the Kansas City Royals yesterday. And David Price, so much of the attention was on him headed into that start because of the lack of wins as a starter in the postseason, 0-7. And he gives up a couple of solo shots in the first couple of innings. And you're thinking, here we go again with David Price. The mislocation of Ben Zobrist in the first inning, second batter of the game, and then the controversial home run to right off the bat of Mike Moustakas. Guy settled down in a huge way after that. Did allow the third run to score, but that was Aaron Sanchez allowing that inherited runner to score. So really, only two earned runs over 6 2/3, five hits, eight strikeouts with two home runs as well. But again, we're left with this piece of information that the guy does not have a win as a postseason starter. Does the narrative continue, Craig, even though the guy, like, there's no questioning that he was very good yesterday. And last year, his one postseason start for the Detroit Tigers, he went eight innings, gave up two earned runs to the Baltimore Orioles. They lost that game 2-1. But does the narrative continue because wins are what everybody looks at?
I think it'll still follow him around a little bit, you know, and I think, you know, sort of the people who still sort of look at wins as a measure of a pitcher, as the be-all, end-all measure of pitcher, even though I don't see how that's possible in 2015. But, yeah, I think that's still going to follow him around a little bit. Next postseason start he makes, people are going to bring that up. He's 0-7, you know. He, you know, got roughed up in Game 5, Game 2 of the ALCS last year. That'll happen. But I think the narrative changes a little bit in the way that now, just as often as I heard, you know, his His poor ERA and stuff like that on Twitter last night for playoff performance. I was also, you know, seeing that the tweet out that he's gotten no run support. And those seven starts that he'd lost previous to last night, it was 12 runs, I think, of run support over that time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, like he's had good pitching outings and he's had some, you know, subpar pitching outings, but he's had zero support. I think the most runs he's gotten in any one of those games is four.
And I don't think that necessarily postseason record impacts this guy going into free agency much. No. It seemed like the person who was most bothered by it was him. Like you could see it in his, you know, press conference before, mm-hmm. you know, game six. He just, you know, I need to get a win as a starter. You could see that it was something that was kind of hovering in the back of his mind.
Right.
And, you know, you go back to that game two when he was having a great game before unraveling, you know, in that, you know, late in the game, you could tell that it was something that was probably weighing on him. But you know, he was great last night. He looked like, you know, a bit off to a shaky start. He was getting hit hard early on those first couple of innings.
Yeah. But, even the outs were rockets.
They were exactly. They were hit. He was, you know, they were connecting off of David Price, and, you know, it was complete opposite with Ventura, whose curveball was just nasty early on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, credit to Price. He really did lock it down. I think he struck out. You mentioned eight strikeouts total. It was like seven of those between the second and I think fifth inning. So, I think he silenced a lot of critics with that performance last night.
And coming off what could be an AL Cy Young performance, somebody's going to offer that guy a crazy amount of money this offseason. Like, I don't think that's going to hurt him going forward in terms of his employability in any way, shape, or form. And I think, yeah, like, baseball people are going to realize that, yeah, everybody has a messy outing now and then. It's not like if Clayton Kershaw was a free agent right now, people are like, subpar playoff record, right? Like, it's small sample size, and it looks bad in the 0-7, but it doesn't look completely that bad anywhere else on his stat sheet.
The Blue Jays bullpen was the subject of some consternation headed into the postseason, especially that meltdown in game 161 by Roberto Osuna. Mm-hmm. Blue Jays had that win locked up in Tampa against the Rays. He blows it. He looked very solid for the majority of the postseason. Just gave up a couple of runs. One was off that massive home run Kendrys Morales hit at Rogers Center. And then yesterday, now he does give up the run, and again, we talked about that play that was created essentially by Lorenzo Cain, mm-hmm. and I've gone back and forth on it. Initially, I thought it must have been a screw-up by Jose Bautista to throw to second base, but guy had a good point post-game. If I throw home, or if I hit the cutoff man going home, we're probably looking at second and third and nobody out, but maybe the run doesn't score. And maybe if Troy Tulowitzki gets a better throw off there, they have Lorenzo Cain at the plate. Mm-hmm. Ballsy call with none out. But that being said, Osuna does take the loss yesterday, gives up one earned run. He's 20 years old, though. What do we make of his postseason, Gary?
I think it was fantastic. I think he gave you everything, you know, you could ask for from a 20-year-old reliever with no MLB experience. I mean, coming into the season, you know, the Jays knew that they were going to have to rely on their young arms, and I think both Sanchez and Osuna did fantastic jobs, even in the postseason here. I don't think anyone could have expected both Sanchez and Osuna to show that type of, you know, they pitched like veterans. Like, you know, you mentioned him giving up the winning run last night and taking the loss, but that was a single. There's no way that, you know, that run is on him.
Yeah, it's tough to say. I mean, you don't want to give up base hits at any point.
No.
And that he bared down and got the double play and got the Blue Jays into the clubhouse or into the dugout with the chance to win that game. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we know what happened in the top of the ninth inning there. It was impressive. But I think we learned a little something, though. And maybe it's a bit of a learning process for baseball fans in Toronto to understand how playoff baseball works. There were not a lot of reliable options for John Gibbons in that bullpen, and certainly not as many as were in the Kansas City bullpen. And that's natural when you got guys throwing 100 miles an hour in Kelvin Herrera, mm-hmm. Ryan Madsen, Luke Hochaver, and Wade Davis, of course. But really, it seemed like John Gibbons was only ever really confident in throwing Roberto Osuna, Aaron Sanchez, and occasionally Mark Lowe. And the forgotten man in all of this is Brett Cecil, who was this team's best reliever pretty much since June, to lose him. And you can't point to one specific instance where they could have used Brett Cecil, but they could have, Craig, seemingly, at some point.
Oh, man, absolutely. There would have been an opportunity to use Brett Cecil at that throughout the ALCS. You know, he's a great pitcher. He didn't give up a single earned run all summer. He had a heck of a second half, you know, as much of a factor in that bullpen and for the turnaround in that bullpen as anybody who was brought in later on or who was put in a new role. I'm a big Cecil fan, and I think that really hurt them, especially losing him on such a wacky play that,
yeah.
you know, that didn't wind up changing that game, didn't wind up changing that inning all that much. That's just, yeah, it was just bad luck, and I think they could have used him. And I think it puts into context all this discussion about should Gibby have deployed David Price a little differently? Like, was it a big insult to David Price to have him, you know, warming up in the bullpen all these times? He didn't have anybody to use.
Right. You know, he had no lefties.
Aaron Loop was away from the team, and Brett Cecil was out. And so what do? Do you just sort of, like, sit on your hands and go, well, we're just going to stick with whoever's on the mound right now? Like, you have to make the awkward decision.
And that freak Cecil injury, what it also did was it exposed Gibby's, you know, John Gibbons' lack of confidence in the rest of his bullpen.
Right. Yeah. And rightly so. When we saw them come into that game.
Yeah, but there were certain situations where I felt like he could have gone to his bullpen a little more. You know, you go back to that game three, going into that, you know, late in the game with the Blue Jays up by several, you know, I think it was like 11-4. Mm-hmm. And Roberto Osuna is still pitching in that game. Like, that's, you know, that's not a situation where you should be bringing in your closer. Like, that should be an off day for your top guy when your bullpen is already so light.
Yeah, it's the pitching as a whole will be an area of concern and needs to be addressed this offseason. We'll get to that coming up in the next hour. Chris Colabello had a spectacular postseason, Gary. He's a guy who I was in the camp of giving him more playing time during the regular season because his numbers against right-handed pitching was so good. And Justin Smoak he had a fine season, hit a bunch of home runs, and the on base wasn't great, and he played great defense at times. For some reason, that defense slumped late in the season. It's not just a postseason thing where the defense started to fall off a little bit. But has Chris Colabello opened your eyes with the way he's played, not just during the regular season, but here in the postseason?
Yeah, totally. I had no idea he spoke Spanish. That's one of the big stories.
And Italian.
He's a man of many tongues. Yeah. No, but he was fantastic for sure. I mean, Justin Smoak, obviously, you know, was not very good these playoffs. He was a strikeout, you know, machine in a bad way. But Chris Colabello came in and gave him that nice pop off, you know, that they were looking for in that offense. And I thought he slotted nicely into that five hole.
Mm-hmm. He led the team in the regular season batting average. Obviously, it was like 90 games or something like that. But he didn't really fall off that well, that hard in the playoffs. He was, what, like third on the team with 282 or something like that? I mean, that's good production from a guy who had previously been really, really untested.
It's interesting to now get a sense as to where this Blue Jays fan base stands after this postseason run. Because for years, and I'm so glad we never have to talk about meaningful September baseball games ever again, because we've gone well beyond that, meaningful late October baseball games for this Blue Jays team. But, yeah, there's a sense of, boy, what could have been there in that ninth inning in Game 6 yesterday. But I think, Craig, overall, the sense has to be, I mean, not quite jubilation, but it's hard to be disappointed with the way this Blue Jays season went.
Absolutely. I mean, how many times do you see a team struggle, fight, scrap, just to get that first postseason appearance in however many years? It could be one, it could be 10, and then flame out. Like, we've seen it, you know, in Toronto with the Maple Leafs, the playoff appearance they've made in the last 5 years, wound up being a 7-game exit in the first round. We've seen it in the Raptors 2 seasons in a row, first-round exits. The Jays, despite the fact that they weren't hitting on all cylinders and they're, you know, They lost players. They lost Cecil. Their pitchers weren't perfect. They scrapped and clawed their way to an ALCS, and they still won 2 games. I mean, I don't understand how anybody could. I mean, obviously, you're watching last night's game. Like you say, you know, there's could have been's, and oh, if we'd only gotten this, but they didn't play that well, and they managed to scrap all the way there. I think that's incredible.
I mean, last night only hurts so much because it's been such a good run.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned it, you know, last couple of years, you know, you hear fans just saying you want meaningful baseball in late August, early September. Mm-hmm. Never mind going on, you know, a stretch run like that, winning the division, getting around in the, you know, winning the LDCS and getting to the CS. So I think it's a great victory. And, you know, you can't say enough for what it does for the young players on this team. You know, a guy like Stroman, you know, who was supposed to miss all the whole season, come back late and kind of help him through that run and look fantastic in the starts he did get. You know, you saw Troy Tulowitzki's comments last night.
Yeah.
And how much having those playoff experiences when he was a young ball player, like at, you know, age 22 and 24, and, you know, how that made him a better ball player. I think you'll probably see that with these young Blue Jays moving forward as well.
And in terms of sort of takeaways from the season, I mean, it wasn't like they just sort of went under the radar and they kind of played a little bit better. Like, this was a season of amazing, like, moments and big time memories and stuff like that. And there's a million things you can look back to. The three home run Edwin game, you know, David Price's first start, every David Price start against the Yankees, you know, like the bat flip. Like there were a ton of fantastic moments that people are going to take away from this season. Like that, you know, young baseball fans are going to remember forever.
Every Kevin Pillar catch in the outfield.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't even get to Kevin Pillar.
We didn't even get to the Ben Revere catch in left field
yesterday.
Wow.
You know what? That's what really hurt most about his last at-bat last night. Like, he had a good game. There was a lot of talk about whether or not the Blue Jays should keep him in that, you know, leadoff spot going into that game and whether or not he was getting on base enough for him. Had a somewhat disappointing playoffs. I think he only had like 12 hits in 11 games, something like that. But he had a great game last night. Like, that was a game-saving catch that he made in the outfield. That was pretty spectacular.
And two hits. He had what would have been a run-cashing sack fly, but the runner didn't get over. I mean, like, yeah, that would have been that was a great game for Ben Revere. Scored a run, couple of hits, major catch, scarred up his arm. You know, he's got the battle scars from that.
And it produced one of the best moments in the game with Colabello showing the ball, his glove to the ump, and the ball was like 5 feet away from him on the floor. That was a pretty funny moment.
And also Pillar like reaching over his sleeve so that Ben Revere could clean up his bloody arm. That was awesome.
Yeah, there were so many moments like that in the postseason. That are almost too many to remember or name right now. Does anybody want to have a conversation about home field advantage? The Blue Jays didn't win in Kansas City at all in this series, and that was at least a conversation the end of the regular season. How much effort will the Blue Jays put into making sure they have home field advantage over the Kansas City Royals, say they meet in the American League Championship Series? I didn't personally have a problem with the way they played it down the stretch. I mean, what are you going to do in the second half? It was just they were a victim of scheduling and weather, really, in Baltimore, that they ended up playing a doubleheader and then played it at noon the next day. Does anybody have a problem with how that went down? And can you point to that as being one of the defining moments in this postseason and in these American League Championship Series?
I didn't even consider it until you mentioned it, but now I'll play devil's advocate and be like, well, you think of that game too. Does that all fall apart if that's at the Rogers Center?
I don't know. You wonder.
Yeah, you do.
I mean, at the time, tail end of the season, when they were obviously just, you know, calling in sick for the remainder, even though they were up a game on the Royals, I remember thinking at the time, like, wow, like, what a giveaway. You know, it's you know, Bush on the aircraft carrier with that mission accomplished sign. You know, it's like, you haven't won yet. Like, let's keep pushing. But at the same point, as soon as I started factoring in, the weather in Baltimore and the doubleheader and everything like that, there's just... Yeah, they didn't have an opportunity in those two games to do anything. If John Gibbons is, like, running his guys out in the second half of that doubleheader or running them out the next day when they could barely keep their eyes open, you look heartless and like you're trying to tear their arms off, right? Like, he was in a no-win situation. He let them sit, and then all of a sudden it's a one-game lead for the Royals, and you're out.
And it was a lot of debate at the time, and if you think about it, it was a lot of debate for just one game.
Right.
You know, you get one extra game, if you meet the Royals in the CS.
Yep.
And they could have very well not even faced Kansas City. Wouldn't even have been an issue, right?
Plus, they started the division series at home against the Rangers. They lost both of those
games.
That's
true. That's a good point.
And they were not unbeatable at home. They lost at home in the one of the three games at home during the League Championship Series. But yeah, I just don't see any other way that they could have played it. Now, that being said, hypothetically, if they had won that game 161 that Roberto Osuna blew, and all they had to do was win on game 162 to guarantee home field advantage, and they started Mark Burley, and he got shelled for 8 runs in the first inning, I might have had issues with that. But as it turned out, didn't matter at all. And the Blue Jays, we know what happened after that. When we come back, and we'll get back into the Blue Jays, no question, after the top of the hour, we'll look ahead to 2016, and there's a lot of question marks as far as free agency. Marco Estrada, David Price, we know about them. Do you exercise the option on R.A. Dickey? What happens to the outfield? Because Ben Revere's not going anywhere. Dalton Pompey appears ready to throw his name back into the mix. Oh, and yeah, there's this guy who was one of the best players in Major League Baseball when he was hurt, Devin Travis, who's returning for a full season, plus a full season of Troy Tulowitzki. We'll get into that after the top of the hour. But coming up next, talk a little hockey. Montreal Canadiens win again yesterday, dominating fashion over the Buffalo Sabres. They're 8-0 and just a couple of wins away from that 10-0 mark at the Maple Leaf share with the Buffalo Sabres. And wouldn't you know it, the Canadiens play the Maple Leafs tonight. We'll talk about them. Oh, also, John Tortorella already making news in Columbus with the Blue Jackets. And we'll touch on the Leafs and Connor McDavid. A whole lot more coming up next. I'm Ben Annis alongside Gary Mello and Craig Battle. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Ryan Dixon.
In rugged Shea Weber and underrated Roman Josi, the Nashville Predators have the premier defense pairing in the NHL. As if that's not enough, the Preds also boast another emerging force on the blue line in the form of 6'4" Seth Jones. Despite the fact his dad, Popeye Jones, was an 11-year NBA veteran, Seth's heart always belonged to hockey, mostly because of its frantic pace.
You know, there could be minutes at a time where the play doesn't stop, and that's kind of the exciting thing is you can't really blink or you can't really leave the TV or else, you know, you might miss something.
Jones's development has taken more of a slow and steady look, playing behind that minute-munching top pair. But now in his third NHL season, Jones is seeing more of the ice and playing in all situations. That could be bad news for opposing coaches like Edmonton's Todd McClellan, who is struck by how good of a skater Jones is despite his size.
He can really get around the rink with that big frame, but when you're not moving, you're able to play in one area and he's still got good range, he's got reach.
Where can all that ability take Jones? We're only just starting to find out. But if he gets where most expect him to go, Nashville will have a big three on the blue line that outshines anything else in the league.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet magazine on newsstands now. And available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Craig Battle. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. We'll jump back into the Blue Jays after the top of the clock and look ahead to 2016 and the question marks that remain for this Blue Jays team. It's going to be a fun offseason. It started a little earlier than many hoped and maybe many expected, but lots of question marks, and it'll be fun to play armchair GM over the coming months. But delve into the National Hockey League season, which is well underway, and some interesting storylines, including the Montreal Canadiens, who, yes, had a great season last year, but you look at the overall nerd numbers, and not even the nerd numbers. You look at the shots on goal and the season that Carey Price had and how important and how integral he was in what the Montreal Canadiens did a season ago. And you thought, well, okay, it's a good team, but I don't know, will they ever be great if they continue that? Well, they're 8-0 this year, all of the wins coming in regulation, and they've outshot opponents. They've totally reversed the style of play, which was a hindrance to them last year. Is this, Gary, a juggernaut? How impressed are you with what the Montreal Canadiens have done here first couple of weeks?
I'm very impressed. I mean, and it goes beyond that 8-0 record. I think it's how they're doing it. As you'd expect, they've kind of, you know, league low in goals against right now. They've only allowed 9 goals in 8 games. I think the second closest team are the Predators, who have allowed 14 goals. But I think what surprised me most is that they're getting some serious offense. And I know that game last night against the Buffalo Sabres kind of helps that a little bit in netting all those goals. You had Markov with a 5-point game. I think he had like 6 Habs in that multi-point game. But it's the fact that they're scoring those goals that surprised me the most. They also lead the league with 30 goals against. Like, that's pretty impressive for this team, considering offense has been their biggest concern.
Are they now the favorites? I mean, it's so early, and it's easy to get into these knee-jerk reactions after just a couple of weeks, Craig. But going into the season, clearly with what the Tampa Bay Lightning did last year and into the postseason, they were the favorites coming out of the East. Have the Canadians kind of supplanted them now as your favorites in the Eastern Conference?
I don't know. I think that's probably still a bit of a three-headed beast, if you will, with Montreal, Tampa Bay, and the Rangers, because it's not like those two teams have fallen off or either is starting slow. They're just not starting quite as hot. And we've seen it before in all sorts of sports. It's not always the team that starts hot that finishes the season hot. So we'll sort of see this tested. Yeah, like, Carey Price, as good as he is, isn't going to be a .966 save percentage at the end of the season. So they'll face some adversity. They'll see some injuries. They'll see all sorts of stuff between now and then. So I think it's still, they're still right up there at the top, you know, 1A, 1B, or 1C, but I don't think they're the clear favorite.
Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
I think what might determine what's that, you know, the best team in the Eastern Conference is what happens with Steven Stamkos in Tampa Bay.
Yeah.
Not to get off too much track here with the Montreal Canadiens, but, you know, he's in his final contract here, and there's been a lot of rumors whether or not, you know, Tampa Bay has been shopping him around and talking to different teams like Buffalo and Calgary, and there's been a lot of rumors floating. So, I mean, Montreal could be the clear-cut favorites if that unfolds as everyone expects it to.
And we haven't mentioned the Washington Capitals either. When Alex Ovechkin plays, they're pretty good. They're 6-1 to start the season. They won five straight. As long as his alarm clock is working correctly. Tonight on CBC, you can see those Montreal Canadiens at home against the Toronto Maple Leafs, who now the attention in this city turns sort of to them. And we'll get to the Raptors as well next hour. But the Maple Leafs have been understandably under the radar here with this Blue Jays run. And the start to the season has been, I think, what we all expected. 4 points through their first six games, one win, couple of overtime losses as well. They've hung in, though. I mean, there's one game that got away from them, that game in Detroit against the Red Wings, but you look at shots on goal, they were right in that game as well. I mean, Gary, you look at it, is this not the ideal scenario for this team to put forth the effort, or at least look like they're putting forth the effort every night under Mike Babcock and reducing the shots on goal, playing better systems, but losing and upping their draft lottery stock?
Well, it's certainly what everyone expected coming in. You knew it was going to be a process under Mike Babcock, and, you know, it was a matter of time. You know, it was going to take time, excuse me, to implement his systems. But they're certainly looking a lot better than how they closed the season last year under Horacek. You know, they're playing more of that Mike Babcock style of hockey, and he's, you know, it's going to take time for him to implement his systems for the players to catch on.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you look at a team like the Arizona Coyotes right now, and they've got some real young studs who are ready to play right now. The Leafs don't have those guys. They're not killing on the stat sheet. They've got Nylander and Marner at the Marlies, but those guys are going to take a little time to get going. So if you can, like you say, actually put forth the effort, you know, improve in ways that you need to improve as a hockey club, and also still not necessarily win a lot of games, and, you know, price yourself out of that top lottery pick next year, where you might get a shot at, you know, the number one pick, top three pick. That's great. That's your absolute ideal situation, because the fans are going to react only if it looks like you're not trying.
You know? And you know what? And they're not going to get a lot of wins this season, but I think if Maple Leaf fans want them to win one game, it's that game tonight against the Montreal Canadiens, you know, especially with them getting closer to the Leafs, you know, who share the, you know, all-time record with 10 straight wins to start a season. I think it would be a pretty Maple Leaf thing to do to kind of get that win tonight and kind of end Montreal's streak.
Mm-hmm. And Maple Leafs hung with the Canadiens opening game of the regular season, and maybe if not for Jonathan Bernier soft goal to start that game, it's a different result that we're looking at. Talking about the NHL draft lottery, the poll sitters for Austin Matthews, somewhat shockingly, is the Columbus Blue Jackets. They had a great second half of the season last year. They were beset by a ton of injuries, and a lot of people saw them as one of the upstarts in the Eastern Conference, could be a real good team this year. 0-8 to start the season. Todd Richards cost him his job. In comes John Tortorella, and it's hard to write a team off after 8 games in the regular season, but 0 points. I mean, that's you almost feel for hockey fans, and there are a few of them apparently in Columbus. Your season's done, Gary.
Yeah, pretty much right off the bat.
It's over. At least, Craig, you're looking at some entertaining post-game news conferences with John Tortorella. That'll be fun.
That'll be great. I mean, yeah, like, you know, combative situations with pressers and stuff like that. That's going to be absolutely great. You know, someone might get sprayed with a water bottle in the stands. That's shareable content right there. You know, the Columbus fans will love that.
That's a move that surprised me. But hearing John Davidson speak earlier this week, and, you know, he said a lot of former players he spoke to said that, you know, playing under John Tortorella at the time may have seemed like hell, but in hindsight, a lot of them said he made me a better player. And, you know, those Columbus Blue Jackets, you know, Ryan Johansson's not going to see that this year. Maybe, you know, he'll probably say that maybe 10, 15 years down the road, but it's going to be a tough transition for that team to get in such an early hole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and things did not end well for John Tortorella in Vancouver. Let's see if they go any better in Columbus, but so far 0-1 with the Jackets as they remain winless at 0-8. When we mentioned the best teams in the Eastern Conference, one of the teams we didn't mention, and rightly so, Pittsburgh Penguins, who we all thought were going to be racking up goals by the bucket load this year. You throw a guy who's a lock for 30 goals, and people talked about him scoring 50 this year, Phil Kessel, hasn't exactly worked so far with Sidney Crosby. And in fact, They're breaking those guys up. That team, for whatever reason, I mean, they've never been a team that's done well on the power play, at least didn't last year. And again, this year, they just have yet to find their scoring touch, Gary.
Yeah, no, I know. It's like, I think they only have 11 goals in seven games, and Sidney Crosby took six games to get his first goal of the season. I'm a little surprised that they're breaking up Kessel and Crosby this early. I mean, the whole point of getting Phil Kessel was because they're constantly looking for that guy on his wing to, you know, for Crosby to feed the puck to. So I imagine this is probably just a short-term experiment to get things going on and, you know, kind of get them back on that offensive track and win a few games. But I'll be shocked if they don't end up back on the same line sometime in the near future.
Yeah, in terms of small sample size overreaction, if that's their move, it's like, oh, it didn't work yet, so let's move on kind of thing. Yeah, you feel like chemistry in the NHL isn't sort of a given, right? Like, and it doesn't happen overnight. That if they believed in it in the offseason, they should have believed in it for at least 10 games.
And as anyone in Toronto can attest to, Phil Kessel is one of the streakiest players you'll ever see. He cannot mm-hmm. score for 10 games and then go on, you know, a huge streak. So I fully expect them to get that together in Pittsburgh.
Big night at hockey today, as mentioned on CBC, 7 o'clock. Leafs in Montreal taking on the Canadiens, also 7 o'clock on City. The Coyotes and Max Domi in Ottawa taking on the Senators, Lightning and Blackhawks. That's at 8:30 on Sportsnet and Sportsnet 1. And then the late game, second half of the doubleheader on CBC, Detroit Red Wings into Vancouver taking on the Canucks. When we return, we'll look ahead to 2016 for the Toronto Blue Jays. How much of an effort do they put into re-signing David Price? And where does Marco Estrada fit in as far as the dollars being spent this offseason? Where does the payroll go this offseason, considering the money that Rogers has generated with this great second-half surge and into the postseason? Also, all right, Dickey, he's got a team option. Mark Burley, does he retire? Devin Travis, what happens to Ryan Goins? There's so much we need to get to coming up after the top of the clock. Going to be a whole lot of fun. Ben Annis alongside Gary Mello and Craig Battle. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Sportsnet Radio Network. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Annis alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello. Blue Jay season done. Dramatic fashion. Boy, they gave us our money's worth both yesterday and all season long. This postseason has been spectacular. It's something we haven't seen in 22 years in this city. It was a great return to the postseason. Glad it didn't end in three games as it looked like it might in the division series, and it went six games in the CS. Could have gone seven, could have gone to the World Series, but I think overall you have to be impressed by what the Kansas City Royals did, including yesterday's 4-3 win over the Blue Jays. So let's look ahead now to 2016, because there's a bunch of question marks, and it's going to be a fun offseason, lots of decisions to be made. I think, gents, though, when you look at the makeup, who's returning, the contract situations for the Blue Jays, it's almost like you look at the starting nine, you don't have to do anything with that. It's set in stone what's happening as far as the offense. It's all in place as far as the position players for next year, Gary.
I think so, and I mean, everyone's pretty locked up. They've got some good options in the outfield. You get Devin Travis back from injury. He's your everyday second baseman, your leadoff hitter. Where this team really needs to focus its resources on, of course, is the pitching situation, both in the starting rotation, and in the bullpen.
Well, let's start with the starters then, because Marcus Stroman's going to be back, we assume, for a full season, unless he uses that terrible auxiliary field in Dunedin and tears up his knee again. I think Blue Jays are going to be extra super careful with everybody's knees. They're going to wrap him in bubble wrap, I guess, come February. But so you got Marcus Stroman returning. Outside of him, though, there's a bit of a question mark. Aaron Sanchez, does he get another shot as a starter? Roberto Osuna, does his stuff translate into the starting rotation? Maybe let's start with those two, and we'll get to some of the other question marks after that. Sanchez, I mean, early in the season when he couldn't hit the strike zone, there was real question in my mind whether he would ever be a starter. He figured it out. Is he a guy you'd like to at least see given an opportunity to earn that starting spot again?
You know what? He's the biggest question mark for me. I mean, you know, he was great out of the bullpen, comes out, throws 97. He's great against righties, but he struggled a lot against lefties this season. He doesn't have as many pitches to choose from as Roberto Osuna. That could be a tough transition back to a starter's role for Sanchez.
At the same point, you know, given the lack of other options, you know, like I'm, you know, when you look at a guy like Drew Hutchison as a potential 4 or 5 starter, I take Sanchez over Hutchison. And I think basically then it just comes down to, is he more valuable to you there in a, hopefully he can start, maybe he can start, can he start? To, is he just a great potential new closer if someone like Roberto Osuna comes into the starting lineup?
Is it a fait accompli that you try Roberto Osuna as a starter next season?
I think you kind of have to give him a look, at least in spring training, and see what happens, right? Because he's been a starter everywhere, and he's been playing pro ball since he was about 2 years old, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
He's, you know, he's got a lot of pitches. He's got the poise to do it, you know, like he's 20 years old. And, you know, you put him in a situation this season where he could sort of get some big league experience, and he just wound up working out really well. But working out really well as a reliever doesn't preclude you from getting your shot as a starter, right? It'll be, you know, a bad thing for the bullpen for him to you know, come to the starting lineup. But I think you have to give him a shot there, you know, next season.
And the question is, where do the Blue Jays spend their money? I mean, it'll cost you a lot more money to go out and get a kind of front of the rotation type starter, you know, like a David Price, a Johnny Cueto, that type of pitcher. It's a lot easier to address your issues in the bullpen. And if you try to convert Sanchez and Osuna into starters, then your already, you know, weak bullpen is further depleted. So it's all a question of how much money the Blue Jays are willing to spend this offseason and where they're going to put it. If they're willing to break the bank, then obviously they're going to have to go out and get another ace. Maybe Marcus Stroman is your ace. I don't know. But I have a hard time seeing David Price re-upping here. So I think you have very little choice but to move, or at least try moving Osuna Sanchez back into that starting role.
So David Price is going to get his money. I think we all agree. He's going to get his $200 million-plus over 7-ish years. Because there's just so many suitors out there. There's mm-hmm. the Dodgers, there's the Cubs, there's the Yankees, the Red Sox. Seemingly every huge market team is in need of a starting pitcher. So he's going to get paid. Will the Blue Jays put up much of a fight? Is that even a contract you would want to give a guy? I mean, there's very rare are the contracts that are 7 years in length that end up looking all that good, whether it's a starter or a position player, frankly, after year two or three. It just doesn't happen, and especially for a starter, it's a lot of money to be spending.
Do we know if the Blue Jays organization is going to offer a contract longer than 5 years yet?
We don't.
So that might be a non-starter, right? Like David Price may have just been a fantastic end of the regular season rental, and that's that. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I was under the impression that 5-year kind of max deal was always tied to Paul Beeson. I don't know if that's correct or
not. Well, we don't know. We haven't heard anything from Mark
Nothing
Shapiro
official.
Yet.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, that could be something where Shapiro comes in, wants, you know, if your first year, you're taking over a team that just is coming off an ALCS appearance, you want to make an impact, that's one way to do it. You know, give Alex Anthopoulos the green light to go out and sign to David Price, or at least make that type of offer and be in the conversation. If you're going to look at contract comparables, you know, he's the same age now that Max Scherzer was last year when he signed his 7-year, $210 million deal, I think it was. So that's just to get you into the conversation. You got to be able to commit $30 million over 7 years to even be in the conversation, to sit at the table with David Price. And considering how many big market teams are in the market for a starting pitcher, you look at the New York Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, the Cubs, Dodgers, you kind of have to go to the 6-7-year deal to even be able to sit at the table.
And I guess if you're reading the tea leaves of sort of this postseason and sort of what he said and what Gibbons has said and how that relationship worked out and how sort of bringing him out of the bullpen for that game in Texas works and how that, you know, fosters a relationship between the team and David Price. You don't imagine, whether, you know, there's any actual animosity there, you don't imagine that he's going to give Toronto the hometown discount, right?
Like, I wonder how much credence we should put on the rumors, the speculation. Everybody's talking about that Jeff Passan article on Yahoo Sports, and David Price has tried to shut it down at every instance. I don't know. Do we think, if we're going to go down that road, can we also go down the road of, hey, he spent couple of months here in Toronto, he's gotten to know the city, he's gotten to know his teammates, seems like he got along pretty well with everybody in that clubhouse, in that dugout. Is there Is there something to be said for that, or is it, hey, he's a mercenary? They all are, and I don't begrudge him 1 second for taking the highest offer. Is it that the situation, or is it if, hey, all things being equal, he'd rather return to Toronto, do we assume?
I don't know. It seems like David Price is a guy who gets along with people, so the fact that he got along with everybody in the organization here isn't a big surprise. But and it was only a few months. I mean, you know, he was in Tampa for years. He was in Detroit last year and the beginning of this one. I don't know that necessarily he's a guy who's been on three teams in two and a half years, whatever. I don't know that he's a guy who's going to feel sort of more at home here than in the other places that he's led. So, yeah, I feel like at this point, he's probably sitting at the table going, you know, what's your situation and how much money are you giving me? The Jays have a great situation for him, but they, yeah, I don't think they're going to get more credence than, say, the Chicago Cubs, who have, you know, just a fantastic team, fantastic young team, and a good roster that can use a guy like him.
I think as long as the Blue Jays are at that, you know, that kind of 6-7 year range and, you know, $25 to $30 million, I think he would have to consider them. Like, give him a great opportunity to win, and that's got to factor in. I mean, he's going to cash in regardless of where he signs. I don't expect him to give anyone a discount at this point in his career. This is probably his last big contract, so he's going to cash in. You know, the only question is, there are other good teams as well that can give him a chance to win. You know, a couple in the National League that have Tampa Bay Rays ties from his days, you know, from David Price's days with the organization. You can go to Chicago and be with your former manager. Like, there's a lot of opportunity there for David Price to kind of test this market. So I think it's going to be really tough for the Blue Jays to be in that conversation.
The nightmare scenario sees him land in either New York or Boston, and you have to face him a whole bunch during the regular season, but we'll see. Also a free agent, Marco Estrada, who has earned himself plenty of cash with the way he's both pitched during the regular season with an opponent's batting average hovering around 200, and the way he pitched in the postseason, just spectacular, spectacular stuff. Now, he is 32, which is not ancient, I hope, and he has a fastball which tops out at about 90 miles an hour, and he's coming off a season that is unlike any other he's ever had in his career. It's a bit of a risky proposition, but signing a free agent always is. How interested should the Blue Jays be in retaining Marco Estrada's services?
I struggle with this one a lot more.
Yeah.
I don't see this as the type of signing that Alex Anthopoulos is known. Like, he's buying high right now, and rarely do you see Alex Anthopoulos do that. Maybe with the exception of trading for R.A. Dickey off his Cy Young season, but Alex Anthopoulos doesn't strike me as the type of GM who is going to sign a guy when, you know, coming off a year like Estrada is. I think the qualifying number I heard was 16 point something earlier.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money for a guy that just is coming off one really good season. I mean, here's a guy that we thought was going to be the sixth starter, a long reliever the last couple of years. So to then turn around and give him that type of contract, that's not something strikes me that Alex would do.
It is hard to ignore what he did this season, though,
and
right?
In the postseason as well. Those two, you know, two specific performances that he had in the playoffs were just phenomenal. Two of the best in franchise history.
Well, and if you're talking about locking up money, and yes, I know Major League Baseball is a non-cap sport, so you're handicapping yourself only in that you have a budget. But the Blue Jays have a budget. They're not the Dodgers. They're not the Yankees. Even the Yankees have a budget these days. Can't do everything that they want to. It seems like we have not reached the limits of the Dodgers' spending yet, so maybe they don't have a budget. But every team operates under a budget, so you can't just talk about in a vacuum, well, the Blue Jays should sign David Price and Marco Estrada, because if it's a screw-up, it's only money. It's going to inhibit your ability to do other things. But is not a four-year, $50 million contract to a guy in Marco Estrada, who may not be the Marco Estrada we saw this year, but still probably good-ish, isn't that a little easier to recover from than $200 million over seven? And what if David Price breaks down? Like, that's a tougher mistake to rebound from. It's big money either way. If you're weighing risk, is there not an argument to be made in that regard?
I absolutely think so. I mean, yeah, like 4 years, 48. I guess, yeah, like it's you know, we're hypothesizing at this point. How much money is, you know, on the table? How much money is he going to get offered? But yeah, I could see $12 million for a guy who was a real quality starter this year, you know, had two quality starts in the playoffs in his three starts. That's a guy, and I feel like he can pitch into his mid-30s at a competent level. So if he doesn't wind up being this guy, and he just winds up becoming a six innings kind of guy, you know, he gives you quality play, but not lights out stuff, I think that's livable. You know, like, we're talking about R.A. Dickey's
right.
option. And do we pick up Ari Dickey's $12 million option?
Well, let's talk about it then, because he's owed $12 million. If Blue Jays decide to exercise that club option, we know it didn't go the way he wanted it to go in the postseason, the way the Blue Jays would have liked it to go in the postseason. His one start in the DS was going pretty good until he was lifted with two outs in the fifth inning, and Blue Jays won that game, so it's hard to knock the decision. But he was holding the Texas Rangers off balance quite a bit. His regular season was very solid. You know what? He's been a very solid regular season starter for this Blue Jays team, and you can write him in pen. You can engrave in stone that the guy's going to throw 200 innings for you, which is, I mean, that's not something you can gloss over. That's a huge thing, especially for a team who's counting on some younger starters and Marcus Stroman coming off an injury, maybe Aaron Sanchez, maybe Roberto Osuna. Is that a no-brainer to pick up that option?
No question. I mean, like you said, you can pencil him in for 200 innings and, you know, 10 to 12 wins, and those are very important numbers over the grind of a 162-game season. You know, it's easy to point at his, you know, postseason performance, specifically this past Game 4, but, you know, you got to get to the playoffs. You know, and to do that, you need arms in your rotation that give you those kind of numbers. And losing Mark Burley, they're going to have a lot of innings to fill, so it's something that I think is a no-brainer for them to bring back Ari Dickey.
Yeah, I think if anyone's trying to think of him as a potential NL Cy Young winner like he was, you know, a few years back, or like an ace or anything like that, they're going to be disappointed. But he's not being paid like an ace. You know, $12 million dollars for an innings eater is a perfectly sound amount of money.
Yeah, it is. I'd be surprised if the Blue Jays didn't exercise that option. Mark Burley, we don't know whether he will continue his career, but if he's on the fence, do you qualify the guy in case he signs somewhere else? That's going to be a bit of a dicey proposition because, as you mentioned, the qualifying numbers about 16-ish million dollars on a one-year deal. But do you protect yourself in case he wants to go back to the White Sox, in case he wants to go to KC or the Cardinals, somewhere around where he is from?
I imagine Mark Burley doesn't want to close out his career the way he did this season with that final game of the season, so I can see him probably want to take one more kick at the can. So maybe if you're the Blue Jays, you do, in the hopes that you get some sort of compensation if he goes elsewhere. But other than that, I have a hard time seeing Mark Burley in the Blue Jays rotation next season.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
I do like seeing him, you know, with the team. Like, I loved, like, you know, one of the sort of underrated things that I think he and LaTroy Hawkins brought to the team was just sort of, like, you know, veteran leadership that the young guys all sort of, you know, loved looking up to. Like, there's the veteran leaders who are just sort of the guys who are separated from the team and sort of lead by example and stuff like that. But Burley seemed to really forge relationships with these guys, and they do have still. Like, if your starting rotation next year includes Stroman, Sanchez, and Osuna, they're all just babies, you know, like they're going to need help throughout the season and they're going to need veteran help. So Burley provides that role. So if it comes at a bit of a premium, I'm, you know, I guess I'm okay with that as long as the term isn't long. Like, yeah, you can't give Burley, obviously he probably doesn't want to play, you know, 4 or 5 years, but yeah, like you can't give him big money in multiple years, but he did have a good season. He had,
guy had an ERA under four. It was 3.81.
He had a good season. He pitched 199 innings. Exactly. Right. Like, He's still a good pitcher, and he can pitch well, despite the fact that his, you know, fastball is probably just a little better than mine at this point, you know, like, and my fastball is not good. But no, he's a good player, and I could see him being a bonus to the team. I don't know that it's going to happen, honestly, but, you know, I think the Jays have to consider it.
All right, let's talk about some of the position players, because, yeah, we think the starting nine is set in stone. Is it, though? Outfield, Ben Revere, I think the guy's under contract for a few years. I think his earliest free agent 2018, but certainly he's at times provided an incredible spark atop the Blue Jays lineup. Who knows if he is still the leadoff man going into next season? But you got Ben Revere in left field. Kevin Pillar is the starting center fielder with what he's done on both sides of the ball this year. He's been incredible. And, of course, Jose Bautista in right. Where does Dalton Pompey fit in here? And then there's the forgotten man in Michael Saunders.
Well, I think Dalton Pompey, he's a guy that is ready to kind of take that next step. He had a much better season in Buffalo. The question is going into next season, is he a guy you want as your fourth outfielder, not getting regular playing time? Like, can Dalton Pompey do any more in Buffalo? Like, is he going to learn anything new? I think he's ready to kind of take that next step. The question is whether or not you're willing to have a player that young with that much potential riding the bench as a fourth outfielder.
And does that stunt his development? What about Michael Saunders? Is he a guy that you're just ready to turn the page on, Craig?
Yeah, I mean, I really wish it had worked out for Michael Saunders. We at the magazine, we wrote a big profile on him and just sort of the rocky road he's had to get to this past season. You know, the injuries and the passing of his mother and, you know, the slumps. And, you know, he basically rebuilt his swing and he was just hopeful beyond belief that, you know, now he gets to do it in Toronto. And he's going to really show people what he can do, because his last season for the Mariners, even though it was sort of cut short by injury, was good. He's a good player. But at this point, banking on him to actually be there and avoid injury, it seems like a losing bet. You know, like, I want it to work out for him. I hope it works out for him somewhere. But when you've got a bit of a loaded outfield like the Jays do, unless it's an opportunity where he can be your fourth outfielder, yeah. Dalton Pompey can be somewhere else.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Maybe you non-tender him, and then you bring him back at a reasonable rate under the understanding that he's the fourth outfielder, and maybe if an injury occurs, he'll get a starting spot and could see the occasional spot start, and you get another full season of Dalton Pompey at AAA. Just not – remember, this is just a couple of years ago the guy was in single A, right? So, yeah, it's not like he's 25, 26 yet. Maybe that's a road you go down.
Yep, and I think that could work because, at this point, I don't think want to start the season banking on him to be your everyday left fielder, Michael Saunders, because you're probably going to wind up disappointed, you know. Like, but if he can come off the bench, if he can be in a situation where he can, you know, show you what he has at a low dollar figure, and maybe he is a guy who would give Toronto sort of the okay, yeah, I'll give you the hometown discount. I just really want to prove it. Like at this point, and he's made some decent money considering he's hardly played at all the last few years. In that role, I would think that'd be a great fit.
And I certainly like Ben Revere's bat a little bit lower in the lineup. Like he brings you such great defense, so I can't see anyone, you know, kind of stepping ahead of Ben Revere on the depth chart, because he was pretty good for them in left field this season. But his bat is a lot more acceptable, I think, a little bit lower in the lineup. If you do have Devin Travis back healthy next season and he's in your leadoff spot, then I think Ben Revere is, you know, very valuable to this team.
So Devin Travis is an interesting guy. Sportsnet Magazine Live, by the way, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Gary Mello, Greg Battle. So Devin Travis was on this incredible pace to start the season. What did he have? 6-7 homers in April. It was incredible stuff right out of the chute. And it wasn't just the home runs. It was the incredible at-bats he was taking the ball the other way, taking his walks, playing good defense. Of course, beset by injuries. The injuries were so, so tough. And he just couldn't recover from the shoulder thing, taking the ball off the collarbone area. Is he automatically your starter at second base next year? Because Ryan Goins really showed us something, at least me. And it wasn't just with the glove. We know he's a great defender. Mm-hmm. He made strides offensively. Is that a tough thing to say to Ryan Goins to start the year? Hey, I know you had a good run and you were a starter at second base and you were good certainly at times in the postseason as well, but you're our utility man now.
But I think that's a good thing. I think the second base job is Devin Travis's to lose. I know he's coming off a tough season with all these injuries and stuff, but I think he's your automatic second baseman going into next season. I think having Ryan Goins, who, again, was spectacular defensively this season, yeah, his bat doesn't give you everything you need in the lineup. I wish he'd learn how to take a bunt. But, you know, I think having him as a utility infielder is a fantastic thing. Certainly better than having the Kawasaki option.
And, I mean, you're going to want to rest Troy Tulowitzki next season. So having Goins is going to see moments at shortstop, and I think that's a great thing. And yeah, he did, like, especially he had that walk-off home run. I felt like a real, like, culmination of Goins did. I mean, he had that walk-off home run late in the season, and it felt like, yeah, like, this is a guy who's figuring it out. He's having his moments, and allow him to keep proving that to you.
There's also a question mark at first base a little bit. You got Justin Smoke there. You have Chris Colabello. Colabello really was an unknown going into this year, did not start the season in the major leagues. He was great in AAA. He was great right out of the chute when he was called up to the Blue Jays in the majors. A lot of people expected him to regress. He did slightly, but the guy hit over 300. He is a hitter. And you know what? He made strides defensively as well. He was at times, and maybe in the overall, this team's best hitter for average in the postseason as well. Is he a guy that you look forward to 2016 is at least getting the shot to start every day at first base?
Do we mention he speaks Spanish?
Yeah, you mentioned it a number of times. All doesn't right. speak That's... Portuguese, though,
Gary. So
we're going to have to get on that.
Yeah. Right.
But no, I think considering the money the Blue Jays need to spend at other positions, I think Chris Colabello is a perfect fit for them at first base. As you mentioned, you know, he's got good pop on his bat. I don't love him in that five hole in the lineup, but I still think he provides them a lot of good stuff, kind of middle to late, you know, in that lineup. So considering how little he's going to cost him, I think it's a no-brainer to bring him back at first base.
So we're looking at a new regime in Toronto, and I mentioned we haven't really heard from Mark Shapiro. He did that kind of weird interview from Cleveland where he was still the president of the Cleveland Indians while the season was going on, while the Indians were in Toronto playing the Blue Jays in a series. So now, I guess as soon as the World Series is over, he becomes the president of the Toronto Blue Jays, and Paul Beeston is done, and what an incredible tenure Paul Beeston had here in Toronto. There's a lot as far as decisions to be made in the executive boardroom. None bigger than what happens to Alex Anthopoulos. I can't wrap my head around any situation in which Alex Anthopoulos is not the GM of this ball club going forward, but nothing's happened yet. Is there a situation? I mean, it's making me nervous that we haven't heard anything yet. Is there a situation where Alex Anthopoulos is not retained as the general manager of this team going forward?
I hope not. You know, I hope there is no way. And yeah, I have no idea what that conversation is going to be like, but I can imagine that Alex Anthopoulos, based on what he did this season, can walk into that boardroom with his agent and say, you know, I deserve to be paid in the upper echelon of baseball GMs and presidents. And then the conversation should just, you know, hopefully go from there. I mean, I guess that's the one thing that you've brought in Mark Shapiro. You wonder what type of decision-making ability he wants, and then how they envision themselves working together. Because yeah, Alex Anthopoulos is a massive, massive reason for their success this season. He made, you know, four moves that absolutely took a team that was floundering to a team that was this close to the World Series. So he's earned his spot, and I feel like the Blue Jays will absolutely recognize that. And it just sort of, you said it, like, we don't know what Mark Shapiro is thinking. So beyond that, I think there's just, it would be crazy for them not to bring him back, but I don't know what that decision-making process is going to be like.
I mean, you hear so many times about new presidents coming in and wanting to put their own guys in charge and want to make their own hires and put their stamp on the team. But to me, how can you not re-up Alex Anthopoulos? Like, as you come into the president, you know, he made those fantastic moves at the trade deadline, Alex did. You know, he's earned his next contract. The only way Alex Anthopoulos is not here for the Blue Jays moving forward is if he doesn't want to be.
Yeah.
And I don't get that impression. I imagine that I wouldn't be surprised if they've already got a deal made up behind the scenes and they're just waiting for this playoff run to end. Like, it would not surprise me to no end to see a contract announced on Monday or right after the World Series concludes.
I would, I'd really be dumbfounded. It would take this season that was such a step in the right direction for this franchise and kind of not ruin it, but it would definitely give you a different feeling going into the offseason where things should just be feeling warm and fuzzy. So we saw great strides, not just made on the scoreboard and in the standings, but in the stands for the Blue Jays here. Late in the season, we saw sellout after sellout in September. We saw incredible attendance and excitement in the stands during the postseason. It was something even more. You ask people who were there 22 years ago, this is a different type of crowd. There's no Winfield wants noise with this bunch. Is there an automatic carryover to next season? We know opening day is going to be sold out. That day after opening day is historically one of the worst attended days in Major League Baseball. Are we going to see a huge spike in attendance building off what happened this year, Craig?
I think we should. Considering, like you said, that the lineup is going to be almost identical and that the lineup was the thing that, you know, with the three guys with the 120 home runs, we've got, you know, tons of excitement around the base paths. We've got a lineup that people recognize, big characters, you know, lots of fun. That's all coming back, you know, like the starting rotation, bullpen, those are big question marks. Those are going to be sorted out between now and the beginning of next season. But the core of your team, the core of your exciting run scoring machine is all coming back. So I can see that the tickets at the beginning of next season, you know, 20, 30 games into the season, you know, if the team isn't taking off the same way you could see it dipping. But for the start of next season, I could see that totally carrying over, absolutely.
I know it's terrible to say, but strictly from a business standpoint, if you're a Rogers and the Toronto Blue Jays, like the Blue Jays losing in the ALCS is probably the best thing for your bottom line. Because, I mean, from a professional sports franchise's perspective, you know, what you're selling every year is hope.
Yeah.
And, like, everyone loved the ride that this team went on this season. And you know what? These crowds are different. These are different than those teams, the crowds we saw in the early 90s. I mean, you can't go into the stadium without seeing, you know, everyone with the Blue Jays cap on and a T-shirt on or a jersey, a Stroman, you know, jerseys everywhere. It's like they're selling merchandise. You know, people are spending money at the games. The fact that they just fall short this season, there is, people are already talking about next season. You know, we're doing it on this show, talking about, you know, how great this lineup is. And this, you're selling hope if you're the Toronto Blue Jays. So I imagine those season tickets kind of take a nice little bump. I imagine their flex pack tickets take a little bump, you know, and everybody comes back excited next year.
Yeah, they already have, especially when you consider people re-upping for 2016 got a head start as far as postseason tickets are concerned. Oh, they're going to play the World Series either way, apparently. It will continue. It starts on Tuesday in Kansas City. Royals and New York Mets, the World Series winners in 85 and 86 hooking up. And one of those teams we could have predicted would be there again this year after making it to Game 7 against the San Francisco Giants a year ago. The other is a huge surprise, but not the way they played second half of the season and down the stretch and with the additions they made, talking about the New York Mets. All right, how do we break it down? You got some pretty good pitching on the Mets side of things, and we know the bats can do some damage for the Kansas City Royals, Gary.
If I were a betting man, I'd probably pick the Royals in this World Series, only because, I mean, they've been there before. As mentioned earlier, they're a pretty well-balanced team. The Mets are a great young team. I mean, their pitching was fantastic, but I wonder how much having a week off is going to affect the hitters going into the World Series. I mean, your timing's probably going to be a little bit off. You know, they're opening on the road, so I'm kind of curious to see how that plays out. But, I mean, the Mets have a lot to look forward to. I mean, that young pitching, like Syndergaard and, you know, DeGrom, they're a fun team to watch for sure, but I would probably give the slight edge to the Royals.
And you wonder, I don't know. I'm torn. I kind of want to pick the Mets just based on the fact that it seems like they're undeterred by the moment just because they didn't expect it. And they're so young, they don't necessarily understand the weight of it. You hear a lot about sort of, you know, guys years on getting that opportunity when they're really young, you know, they're in Stanley Cup or the Super Bowl or whatever. And they're looser than guys who are older because they don't necessarily know that they might not get back.
Yeah.
You know, like they're having success early and it's just sort of like,
it's every year.
This is par for the course, right? Like you just do this sort of stuff. The Royals were there last year. They want to get over that hump. And they don't strike me as a team that rattles easily. Obviously, they didn't in the ALCS. But they want to get over the hump. They're going to be tight, I feel like. They're going to have the home crowd cheering them on, you know, which we saw for the Jays can be a bit of a double-edged sword, right? Like, you know, you want to win. You want to get the win. You want to get out of your home. And I feel like the Mets will be playing pretty loose because they're still playing with house money.
And credit to them. I mean, nobody expected them to walk all over the Cubs the way they did. If I remember correctly, I think they were 0-7 against the Cubs.
Yeah, they were.
In the season. They come out and they swept them in four, man. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy stuff. Before we go, take a break here. If you're a Blue Jays fan, who do you want to win this thing? Do you want to say, hey, we lost to the eventual World Series champions? Or do you just hate the Royals so much you want to see them lose?
Well, it's one thing, too, as a Blue Jays fan, are you going to be cheering for Syndergaard and Darno to do well in the World Series? Does that sting a little bit more if they kind of roll over the Royals and they win it? That's a good point.
I think you're cheering for the Mets. I think, yeah, like you especially considering the sort of, like, you know, run-ins they had with the Royals during the season, there was a lot of bad blood that didn't really show up in a lot of ways.
Do you want to see Yordano Ventura raising that World Series trophy over his head?
Don't. If you're a Jays fan, you absolutely don't want to see that.
Same if you're an A's fan as well. When we return, the Toronto Raptors open up their regular season next week on Wednesday at home against the Indiana Pacers. Big offseason for them. Damare Carroll and Corey Joseph returning to his home country. Different feeling for the Raptors going into this year where expectations were raised with a couple of postseason appearances, but not ending the way they wanted to in a four-game sweep to the Washington Wizards a year ago. We'll look ahead to the Raptors' upcoming season. Coming up next segment, this is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello. It's the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Dave Serum.
Heading into last year's playoffs, the Toronto Raptors were missing something. Paul Pierce called it, that undefined intangible that only the truly good teams possess. Four games later, after being brutalized by Pierce's Washington Wizards, it was clear that he was right. Missing that certain something, The Raptors now seem to have found it in Damari Carroll, this summer's marquee addition. In Carroll, not only have the Raptors gotten the defense-first small forward that they've coveted for years, they've also gotten a selfless worker who's willing to leave it all on the floor.
As many of y'all may read, I've been through a lot of obstacles throughout my life, from being shot in college to having a liver condition, for an organization to take me under their wing and bring me here and look at me as a true part of this team means a lot.
It's been a long road for Carroll to get here, and fortunately for the Raptors, every step along the way, he's learned exactly what it means.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine on newsstands now. And available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free.
Yeah. Jumpin', 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 them boys up to something. They just spent like 2 or 3 weeks out the country. Them boys up to something, they just not just bluffing. You don't have to call, I hear my dance like Usher. Ooh.
11:43 Sportsnet Radio Network. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Craig Battle. It's Drake's birthday apparently today. Aubrey Graham. Happy birthday, Drake. I haven't double checked that information, but I haven't been led astray before. So I don't know why I would today. So happy birthday, Drake. Emil Delich giving me that information. All right, so Raptors start their season, regular season styles, on Wednesday at home against the Indy Pacers. It's an interesting feeling going into this season. I guess part of it is the Blue Jays run is kind of just everything's taken a backseat. And now we can start kind of changing gears and moving forward in our lives and start thinking about the Raptors and hopefully not thinking back to that embarrassing 4-game loss to the Washington Wizards in the opening round of the playoffs last year. But they pick up Damari Carroll, big offseason signing, a couple of other tweaks, and pretty good draft class, we think, although not one or two overall, but showing a little promise here in the preseason and in summer league. Overall here, Craig, what's the outlook for this team going into Wednesday?
I think they're still they're a similar team to what they were last year. Like we can make a lot of arguments about sort of smaller moves, but the core of the team is still there. The Eastern Conference looks largely similar to what it looked like last season. So, you know, heading into the season, you have to sort of imagine that they're about a potential fourth or fifth seed in the playoffs. They're not the Cavaliers. They're not the Bulls. Miami's going to take a step forward. Atlanta still looks strong, that sort of thing. However, what I'm most interested in heading into the season is how that offense is going to look now that they've sort of jettisoned a few players from last season. They lost Amir Johnson, who was their best screen setter. They lost Lou Williams, who was sixth man of the year, you know, really shot the lights out in some games from the second unit. And they lost Grievous Vasquez, who did the same thing, right? But the bad part, the downside of having those two ball stoppers in the backcourt was that they didn't move the ball a lot and the offense can get stagnant, and that really came back to bite them in the playoffs. So they're committed to moving the ball, and then it's just going to be sort of can everybody else buy into that? You know, JV and Kyle Lowry and DeRozan last season could stop the ball a bit. So everyone's going to have to buy into that, and they're going to have to sort of make shots off the catch and keep the ball humming.
Yeah, it's really curious to see how much that offense changes on the team this year. They weren't a very good ball-moving team last year. You know, we mentioned Corey Joseph coming in. He's probably going to be your first option off the bench now, especially in the backcourt. So it's a question of that team, whether or not they can play a better half-court offense and move the ball a little bit more and kind of create more offense. You know, Lou Williams was notorious for coming in and kind of just jacking shots.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, as good as he was as a scorer for them, Corey Joseph is definitely a different type of player. He can give you that offense, but you imagine his goal is going to be a distributor first, I would think.
And both of those guys are essentially Greg Popovich acolytes, right? Like Budenholzer having sort of that pedigree as well in Atlanta. So those guys have both seen that work really well. Like let's move the ball and let's get the best shot. Like, we don't necessarily need our best player to take the shot on every given play, like Lowry or DeRozan sometimes took upon themselves last year to get the points, right? If you can get Pat Patterson in the corner, get a Damari Carroll three that's wide open off some really great ball, drive and kick, ball movement, that's exactly what you need to do. Like, and hopefully that helps DeRozan and Lowry maintain themselves in the course of the season, that they're not driving into the middle of the paint trying to make something happen. They're not, you know, pounding the rock for 22 seconds every time they come out. So it's just, can the team buy in and can they survive without that, their second unit destroying second units of other teams?
Well, we look at what went wrong last year, and there were two things. And I think the most glaring or the most evident seemingly was the lack of offensive ball movement, but the defense was really horrible all season long. Gary, and you look at Dwayne Casey returning for yet another season. How big a season should this be for Mr. Casey, who is known as a defensive guru? Couldn't get this team to play defense last year.
Well, I mean, they've made some good additions, so he's certainly gotten better tools to help him on the defensive side of the floor. If that team doesn't improve defensively this year, I'd be surprised. But for Casey, I think the real key will be getting him back into the playoffs and going around. It was a very disappointing kind of end to the season last year. They're hot out of the gates. Some of that had to do a little bit with Kyle Lowry hitting a bit of a wall after the All-Star break, even though we all voted him in, probably worked against us all. But I think for Dwayne Casey, I think improving that defense should be easier this year with the additions they've made. I mean, Biombo, he's a game changer when he's kind of in the paint. You know, his wingspan's great. He's a blocking machine. So I have a hard time seeing them not improving at that end of the floor.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, we're talking about the offense before, but the big moves this summer were all made to improve defense and to give Dwayne Casey the horses that he needs to play that defense, which is more demanding on players than some other guys. You know, like the Tom Thibodeau pack the paint kind of defense wasn't what Casey was playing last year. They were trapping a lot. They were forcing guys to give up the ball and sort of making everybody recover, that kind of thing. And now they've got Corey Joseph and Damari Carroll, who are much better at that type of thing. Just in terms of keeping guys outside of the three-point line and slowing down the point of attack kind of thing. It'll be great to see what Dwayne Casey can do with guys who are going to buy in and have the ability to do that.
What do the Raptors do with the four?
That's a good question. Right now, it looks like they're going to start the season with Luis Scola at the four. And we saw in the FIBA Americas this summer that guy's got a lot of talent still. You know, he's a veteran. You know, he's mid-30s. He's not going to light it up every night, but he has the capability to do so, and he is solid in just about every facet. You know, like he moves well on defense. He works with others really well. He's going to fit with Jonas Valanciunas. He's going to fit with anybody in that offense. It seems like that's going to happen. But Patrick Patterson is a bit of a wild card, right? Like, he shoots the ball really well from three. He's probably a better defender when you get switches and stuff like that. And if he has to be on a perimeter defender, he can do that a little bit. He can defend the pick and roll pretty well. But he's not necessarily going to bang with a power forward on the other team or a center if that's the switch. So I like him on the second unit just in the way that he's going to help with your spacing. He's going to get those threes, especially if he's playing with Bismack Biyombo. I think that's a much better fit that way.
Where's the goalpost for this team this year? Is it winning around? Anything short of that is a disappointment. Anything after that is gravy.
I think you need to win the division again. I think that's the first kind of benchmark you need to set for this team. And then once you get into the playoffs, you need to go around. Because, I mean, that performance against the Wizards last year was very disappointing. You could go, lose in seven games. And, you can lose in the elimination game, and it would be better than what they did last year against the Wizards. Mm-hmm.
Big Raptors preview in the current edition of Sportsnet magazine as well. It's the one, of course, you'll notice with Jose Bautista's bat flip on the front cover. But yeah, breaking down the upcoming Toronto Raptors season, which gets underway on Wednesday at home against the Indy Pacers, has a big preview, including a look ahead to what the Raptors have in Damari Carroll and where this team goes with the new additions. How they improved their defense, which was horrible all season long last year, and which was kind of glossed over by the incredible offense first half of the season and then exposed second half of the season. All right, that'll do it. Another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today coming up in just a second. Thanks to Craig Battle, Gary Mello. I'm Ben Ennis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.